So, anyway, the first one's called Antiquity. How do we listen to early music? We may admire the attempt at authenticity, the attention to period instruments, yet we cannot erase the centuries of listening that have come down to us since. If the music sounds to us austere, can we know at all how it was heard then? In the reproduction of that antique art, how do we reproduce the listener? The enjoyment is ours now somehow, even if the music seems reduced, stripped of later possibilities, a lovely bygone relic carried down to us by the wonders of scholarship and imagination. When early music was just music, did the instruments sound strange and stiff as they do now? No doubt there were still mad ambitions and the sense that music could be all. Okay. Now, also, some of the texts are, well, a few, dwell in, let's say, the quotidian, and this is one, called Shower Drip. Water drip, drop, drip. When you've lived in California, if you're conscious, you learn to not take water for granted. Some 45 years ago, after my family moved to the West Coast and the concepts of ecology and recycling and drought began to filter into my teenage mind, I took on the habit of turning off the shower between first getting wet and later rinsing off. Beyond the pasty sounds of wet soap and its lather applied all over my body, a sampler of the house noises emerged as if in an unguarded moment, an interval in which the soundbox of my head was not immersed in that rain pouring down upon it. A toilet flushing through the pipes, warm air rattling up along the central heating ducts. Out the bathroom window, the trickle of the little stream below, the ha-ha-ha of the whatever bird, the thin descending whistle of some other bird. The sounds around me surfaced unbidden until they washed away again. But enough of my shower habits, except to note that a certain small instinct took hold as well, a reflex of the ear, alert for the signatures of waste. I am often surprised by what others do not seem to hear. The toilet running, which thus suggests that anyone who so left it should bother to get up and jiggle the handle, unless that task falls to the person who couldn't help noticing the problem. What gets me the most, though, is the dribble, drip, drip in the men's showers at the gym. This is a previous gym. I say to the two people I know. One stall in particular, and others too sometimes. I don't know how, in a place where people go to maintain or build their strength, so many can be so oblivious that they do not bother to shut off the faucet completely. How can people be so careless that they manage not to even notice? I listen without trying for the drip, 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 and if I'm merely passing by the showers on the way upstairs to the machines and the weights, I'll make a detour to turn it off. And certainly, if I'm in a stall nearby, amazed as I am to see the person walk away, even someone I know, and leave the dribbling behind, I wait till they turn the corner before I step over quietly and shut the handle. So, okay, now, the one most recurring type of piece, there are 11 of them spaced, scattered throughout the book, is about going to concerts, concert going, which was sort of the starting point of the book. I was sitting at a house concert in my neighborhood and for some reason thinking of like how many, many, many concerts I've seen in my life and just kind of sort of amazed. And then that just spread to listening and listening and thinking, well, that's what I'm doing all the time. Thinking of concerts through my life, how do you account for it? The very first piece in this is thinking to a Richie Havens concert when I was maybe 12. This is the second piece, so also in that early time. And as the pieces go further on, there are just so many I can't account for them. And so I start writing about the circumstances, which I find more and more is the case, or writing about the places I went, you know, where I was, whatever. So anyway, this one is called, and the last two in the series are actually on single concerts. But this one is Concert Going to Janice Jim ISB. Half a century after they recorded, I listened again to Janis Joplin with Big Brother and the Holding Company, the Cheap Thrills sessions. I don't know how she would have lasted even to middle age the way she used her voice. Like she was hauling a lifetime full of blues, and she was only 25. The musicians, on the other hand, sound nice, but not so psychedelic as I thought I remembered, and their playing not so sophisticated either. That summer, was it 1968? I saw them play at Convention Hall on the boardwalk in Asbury Park. No, say the Webs, she played there on August 23rd, 1969, a week after Woodstock, and no longer with Big Brother. For lack of evidence to the contrary, I'll imagine that was the date. I also saw the Doors at Convention Hall, what I thought was the same summer, but apparently not. Thanks to rock obsessives online, I find it was August 31st, 1968, that the Doors played in Asbury Park, which poses another mystery. That was my father's birthday, just 44. Would he have let me, at the age of 12, go off to a rock concert? Well, maybe so, all the more if my brother and sister were out that night too. Maybe the three of us went together, lucky them. Recently, I found a recording on YouTube of Jim and the boys doing Light My Fire that very night in Asbury Park, preceded by him doing a poetry thing over some improv business from the musicians. If I saw any such art when I went, it didn't register. Sometime during the ensuing school year, eighth grade, I sang Break On Through, and possibly that song too, in a band with my friends that lasted barely a few months. We didn't get arrested. But listening to the recording of The Doors from that night, which I must have heard live, though I probably went to the early show, I'm struck once more by the relative simplicity of the music, even if they do rock on for a good 9 minutes. I can almost recall the excitement of going, the anticipation in advance of each song, and wondering, like everyone else, if Jim would behave that night. That fall, on November 27th, the eve of my birthday, unless it was the following September, these are the dates the electronic memory bank says they played there, I went to see the incredible string band at Fillmore East in Manhattan. I must have been almost in heaven. I was invited by my sister's boyfriend, Joey Rubin, a guitarist in the band, who knew I liked them and offered to take me. That meant him driving the 60 miles from the Jersey Shore. What did we do for parking back then? I think it was just the two of us, but in truth, I don't remember the drive. No, my sister must have gone, and I'm inclined to figure it was the earlier date, since both of them were four grades older than me and seniors in high school still. Whichever date, I only went one other time to Fillmore East, and that was an escapade full of deceit, close calls, and blind luck, which I think I wrote about in another piece, but I'm not sure if I did. This one is called Foreign Enchantments. Also one page. The enchantments of a foreign voice speaking in a language I will never understand. In the present case, Norwegian. A new record by the harpist Ellen Bodker with the poet Jan Erik Vold, who takes us over hill and dale, his weathered voice still full of wonder. Of course, I have no idea what he is saying except for the titles, and after several times listening, I still postpone reading the translations of his poems. I like hearing the voice. The actual words don't matter as much, at least not yet. His warm tones seem comforting, animated yet down to earth, telling us such stories. Once Upon a Summer is the name of the record, and also the longest piece, or rather, Sommeren der Ute. I'm not sure I hear summer in his voice, or in her harp either, but dappled moments. I just want to go where he goes. So in thinking about listening from all sorts of directions, this is one of these that's tries to extend it a little bit, and it's called Listening as Speech. Can listening function as a kind of speech? No doubt. And yet on the surface, the two would seem incongruous. If we think of listening through the implication of hearing, what is taken in, often involuntarily, as part of the senses, that seems hardly to align with the idea of expression, a pushing out, utterance. At best, they appear opposite, symbiotic processes that perpetuate each other. But listening is also about choice, be it conscious or instinctive, regarding where to spend the effort amid an array of possibilities. That choice says something about who you are, how you felt that day, what you thought of the options at hand. Your musical tastes, for instance, tell us whose company you prefer to keep and even how you view the very act of listening. Further, the music you choose at a given moment in a certain context often conveys to anyone nearby unmistakable messages. Keep out. Come in. I'll show you. Stay here with me. To listen is to stoke a memory or to poke a memory. To bring it into the light of the present day, not as a ghost, but as an old friend, where listening is a response to what had gone before. And so it must be, for the present moment does not exist in a vacuum. Even the eternal present ongoing comes armed with some form of memory. In conversation, your interlocutor will not likely know who stands there beside you, summoned from the shadows. But as they speak, the tone, the angle, the presence and embrace of your listening carries a hint under the surface of where you would go with their words. To make a semblance of listening, as when a cop or a parent seeks to lecture you, is to let them know, while not letting on, all right, we can play this game if we have to, but let's not take all day, for we both have better things to do. Obviously, listening does not use words to speak, but it does use everything else. Eyes, body, wind, world, even speech itself, the reception of speech. What more can listening do than to say, in effect, I hear you, I don't hear you? All right, and this is called The Unheard. Those of us who learn to seek out challenging music at a fairly young age, how did we develop a sense of direction in our pursuits? Like many of my generation, the dissatisfaction of rock, the dissatisfactions, plural, of rock led me elsewhere, along less popular paths or of slightly more difficult access. But that is not quite right either, for I was hearing very different kinds of music at more or less the same time. When I was 12, my college-age brother gave my mother for her birthday John Coltrane's final album, Expression. Coltrane had died that year. It registered with me at the time, but not like Donovan or The Doors. Coltrane's music would still take me a few years to grow into. But in the voyage that is listening to music, are there places it would be dangerous to go? No matter, we go there anyway. Even polka fanatics have their visions. Besides, it's only music. All we can do is drown a little. I have no doubt that, more than pictures, music grants us our first glimpse of the outside, some detail that seems strange to us that we didn't know before. The hunger for the new, the previously unheard, might be unreasonable in its way, listening for what is not there yet. Not everyone is like that, I recognize, but all listeners have their inclinations, something they want more of. Our appetite for the unfamiliar will vary with each person, as will our sense of what is familiar. However you take it, there is always an outside, a beyond, a mystery of space. Just as, if we listen to Charles Ives, for instance, there is also a mystery of the familiar. Either way, these are mystical experiences one is working toward, or at the threshold of the mystical. No surprise, therefore, that music may be intoxicating.
Oh, now the birds stop?
Okay. All right, we didn't sync this, did we? Right. Interlingual transcription. Yeah, I've done a fair amount of interviews, mostly with writers and musicians over the decades. And so I have a few pieces that relate to those experiences, because that's listening too, of course. But this has to do with the tedious task of transcription. Most of the literary interviews I did in the 1980s in Paris were done in French. But since my thoughts were toward publication in English, a curious process developed. When I transcribed the interviews, listening to the French, I wrote directly in English. Though the recordings still exist, there is no transcript of what was actually said, only a translated transcript. or rather, a transcript that is a translation of what was said. For my purposes at the time, that interlingual listening was the most efficient way to handle a time-intensive task. I felt, too, that hearing the writer speak would help make a more faithful translation. And in the meticulous listening that is the act of transcribing, I found more than a few French lessons. My ear at the level of individual breaths, language laid out like a brick road. To write what I hear, but as if seated in an interstitial space, in an interstitial place, at a flip in the language switch. Metaphors can't get at what's going on, really. Too complicated. But that expediency is all around us, where the original text does not exist. We make do with what we have, and the fictions build from there. Think if we got it wrong somewhere in the translation. We didn't hear what we thought we heard. The wind got in the way, noises. It would not be the first time that a history, a culture, grew out of false assumptions. And we were listening so carefully. Did our distraction take the language for a spin? Or did we just not know it as well as we imagined? Interlingual listening presupposes, after all, a certain fluency in the sounds of the language heard. We become interpreters, but to the page. The more I think about it, how could there not be cause for worry? When I listen in my own language, I get things wrong sometimes. So it's all the more likely when transcribing from another tongue, no matter how many times I listen to some parts, that I got details wrong now and then. Of course, I don't think I did, but I'm not going to know. So, all right, this is another short one called Skin Listens. And at the center of it is a short six-line poetic fragment from, anyway, you'll see. Skin Listens. Poetic fragment found in an old notebook from over 20 years ago. Just the one page filled, the rest unused, waiting. Must have known somehow that I'd be writing this book one day. Forms of listening. My daughter's arm over the edge of the bed at night. Arm knowing where the bed ends. Skin against the surfaces, a drum. But it's true that the skin listens. Consider the lovers whose bodies move as if in dialogue. We are each a walking, talking drum, sounded by wind, sun, air, others' gazes, sounding in turn through the jungle of this world. Okay. Yes, my favorite bookmark is Paris Metro tickets. Yes. And I've got a pile of them. and to the degree that our son, when he went for a short visit to Japan, and I'm always saying, don't bring me anything that I don't want more things. He brought me back Tokyo Metro tickets because you know, which was perfect.
They used or unused?
These are all used, yeah. So, right. And I don't think they issue them anymore. I'm not sure. Yeah. Right. Well, they do electronic stuff. Yeah, the Navigo. Yeah. Familiar voices. Roar of the crowd. We strain to listen to the person sitting next to us. Across the noisy street, no use trying. We cannot hear our friend who shouts and gesticulates in a pantomime of communication. The crackling phone line when we pick up. In the sonic hailstorm, a familiar voice emerges just enough that we persist in a confounding effort at recovery. Such obstacles quicken our determination to listen through them, and still we may end up lost, grasping at the tatters of a connection. We don't need much to draw us on. No Pied Piper, just the glimmer of a voice we know that knows us. We will plunge through darkness, through bewildering wreckage for the sake of a voice. The voices of those who have been close to us in our lives, parents, siblings, children, friends, teachers, stay with us. Even after a long absence, we would recognize them. Though the voices may change with time as a face changes, and as our memories also may shift a little in our perpetual realignment with the present. Nonetheless, we would likely find our way back again. Those voices are like keys in the lifelong elaboration of our own music, A distinct and mysterious chemistry informs each of them. The individuality we recognize, however, is predominantly language-bound. If someone we know or knew so well were to speak to us unseen in another language, one we understood but had never heard them speak, would we still be certain who they were? That is none too sure. It would be strange. And if in a language whose sounds were completely foreign? Probably not. Or at any rate, that person long familiar will suddenly seem foreign too, as if in a troubling dream. We want to be guided by our voices, comforted by them, tuned as we are to their pitches and cadences. Okay, I think I have one more. This one is called Healers. A person employed in the care and maintenance of certain machines cannot hope to accomplish the task without a trained ear. How many times have we taken our car to a mechanic? They listen a few moments and come up with a diagnosis. Presumably, they hear the same sounds we do, but they know how to read them, while we can hardly advance beyond saying, "That doesn't sound right." I came up with the same brilliant conclusion the other day when trying to get an external disk drive to work with my new laptop. Likely a problem of software, but I heard the stuttering mechanism as a failure to engage, to read the disk, because that much I thought I recognized from the fickle disk drives in other devices. Doesn't sound right. May indeed be a long way from being able to divine the particulars. The smooth running of an engine, or a motor, or any mechanical contraption, that much we can hear. But to discern the pathologies that may develop, the alphabets of friction, from the processes of a specific kind of machine takes some education, and above all, the familiarity of experience. That car mechanic has heard hundreds, thousands of such engines. He or she knows those sounds better than their own child's breathing. Doctors too, of course, with and without stethoscopes, must learn to listen, whether or not it suits their personality. But bodies, as well as people, also lie, and so the doctor has to hone a special instinct for listening past deceit, even if that takes them onto shaky ground. Through listening, if we are not too impatient, we are likely to know far more than we realize. What a mechanic or a doctor tries to do by listening into the problem at hand is not much different from the so-called whisperers, dog, horse, dolphin. The implication for those apparent miracle workers is that they know how to talk to animals where the rest of us do not, or to especially troubled animals. But that means they appreciate both the general characteristics of the given species as well as the unique variations of the individual. Talking to animals, however, as to people, is not an isolated act. A richly developed capacity for listening, even beyond human terms, is paramount. How do they learn how to listen to such animals? Who knows? They had teachers, including the animals themselves, or they figured it out somehow. But as with any listening, the learning is never finished. To whisper in such circumstances is a sign of humility, a suggestion rather than a decree, almost a form of listening in the very act of speaking. The intimacy of the whisper is like a confession for your ears only, you and me, here in this moment. That the animal is also listening, we could nearly take for granted. But there is the real breakthrough. The creature, convinced by experience of the less than stellar nature of the human species, though probably unaware of the monstrous exaggerations of the self, nonetheless responds by listening to the individual's calming voice and proffered hand. We might even say that animals take pity on the whisperer, confirming the efficacy of their listening and thus exalting their humanity. That's it. Thank you.